called the Nobel Prize. Swedish people and politicians have always tried to preserve Nobel's peaceful legacy after his death, especially in the turbulent 20th century. They maintained their neutrality in both the First and Second World Wars. And even remained neutral during the Cold War. But there was violence and terror under the skin of this peaceful facade. No one would have thought that in 1986, Olof Palme, the then Swedish Prime Minister, would fall victim to the violence that Alfred Nobel tried to prevent by universalizing his Peace Prize. The assassination of Sweden's Prime Minister was difficult for the people of this country and shocking for the people of the world. Sweden, a peaceful country, had faced a new challenge: terror and violence. On September 11, 2003, Anna Lindh, Sweden's then foreign minister and social democratic politician, was stabbed to death by an assailant while shopping in downtown Stockholm along with a close friend. She died in hospital a few hours later. No one would have thought this would unleash a domino effect of violence and terror in Sweden. The resemblance of this murder to that of Olof Palme was controversial. Many had come to believe that the door to violence had been opened in Sweden. This level of atrocity was a shadow of the violence that Swedish weapons had inflicted outside the country. It seemed like the spilt blood had returned to exact revenge. It may seem hard to believe, but Sweden is among the world's top arms exporters. In 2017 alone, Sweden earned 3.5 billion euros from arms sales. Though it tries to show itself as a pacifist country, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, Sweden is in fact a major arms exporter. It's as if this country is pretending to be what it's not. They sell weapons to countries that kill innocent people.
One, they say you have to be my wife by force, like they do raping and all this time. But I talk to them.
Despite Sweden's claim to pacifism, the country's wealthy companies, such as Lundin Energy, play an effective role in organized genocide in developing countries for their own economic gain.
I was 17 when the war broke out in my place I was, so I saw a horrible situation when we got a news that the village is going to be attacked by a militia.
They made a deal with militants to secure an oil-rich region. In return, the militants set fire to people's houses, raped and killed women, and forced people to become displaced.
And I saw my people dying. children and women.
Meanwhile, Borg Ekholm, the CEO of the Swedish company Ericsson, recently admitted that the telecommunications giant had given money to ISIS as a bribe and that all the money had been spent on terrorist activities in Iraq.
Hate crimes in Sweden have seen a record rise, with cases jumping 14%.
The violence that quietly permeated the land of reindeers now wanted to make its presence public. Statistics show violence is on the rise in Sweden at an alarming rate. Research suggests that Swedish society is being affected by a social epidemic of violence and that armed crime is spreading like a contagious disease. As a result, in addition to social initiatives, the police of this country have resorted to a series of repressive measures to de-escalate the situation.
Den krypterade tjänsten Encrochat. Nu slås nya grupperingar, ofta mycket unga personer och makt.
Dozens of graves in a cemetery south of Stockholm belong to the victims of armed conflict. Half of the mothers sitting in this picture in front of the Swedish Interior Minister lost their children to violence. A young immigrant asks Sweden's Social Democratic Interior Minister, Michael Damber, "Have you ever seen so many mothers whose children have been killed?" Organized kidnapping is also on the Swedish government's agenda. The government of Sweden denies claims that Swedish social service agencies kidnap Muslim children. This is while many immigrant families have held campaigns under the title of "Stop Kidnapping Our Children." These families say Sweden's Social Security Agency takes away their children from them because it claims the children's parents are unsuitable. Many Muslim families in Sweden have filed complaints against this agency. The families call this act of forced child-parent separation some sort of legal kidnapping. It is not without reason that Bild, the most widely circulated media outlet in Germany and the European Union, cites a wave of armed killings in Sweden in an article entitled "Sweden is the most dangerous country in Europe." It places the country at the top of Europe's gang crime list. In 2020, 124 deadly violence cases were confirmed in Sweden. The average lethal violence in the last 10 years was 100 cases per year. This growing trend of crime in a European country claiming to be peaceful is not normal. The Swedish government's inability to manage the situation is such that half of Swedes have lost faith in their country's criminal justice system. This is according to a survey by the Office for Crime Prevention, which is affiliated with the Swedish Ministry of Justice. Despite this, for politicians, it's business as usual. They hold the Nobel Peace Prize event every year with confidence. Former Myanmar Prime Minister Aung San Suu Kyi, who not only did not condemn the organized genocide of Rohingya Muslims in her country, but rather defended such crimes in the International Court of Justice.
Mr. President, the court has been asked to apply the 1948 Genocide Convention, one of the most fundamental...
Barack Obama, who Trump calls the founder of ISIS in the Middle East.
They've created ISIS. Hillary Clinton created ISIS with Obama.
Shimon Peres, the prime minister of a regime that constantly commits war crimes against the Palestinians. And last but not least, Menachem Begin, the former Israeli prime minister, who in an interview with the New York Times reporter Oriana Fallaci officially introduced himself as a former terrorist. All of these mentioned names were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. In In line with its pacifist claims, Sweden passed laws that allowed it to deal with international crimes, such as war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity, regardless of where they were committed. These laws gave the Swedish government vast powers to prosecute people from all over the world. However, in 2002, when peace activists filed a complaint with the Swedish police against then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for crimes against humanity, they soon realized that the prosecutor had stopped his investigation. The prosecutor's office refused to send a judicial team to Israel, claiming the probe was impossible. Perhaps the prosecutor was afraid that Zionist groups would do the same to the fact-finding committee as they did to Forky Bernadotte. Forky Bernadotte was a Swedish diplomat. He went to Israel to investigate the Arab-Jewish conflict, but was assassinated by Israeli extremist groups.
I think I have the right to believe that we sooner or later...
It seems Sweden's claim to peace sometimes fails in the interest of Swedish politicians, despite the high costs they incur for Swedish taxpayers. The Swedish prosecutor's office failed in the case of Ariel Sharon. Instead, Swedish police, in a joint option with the CIA, arrested Julian Assange on charges of moral misconduct. Julian Assange was the one who published the documents of the US killing of civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq by launching the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. Earlier, Swedish authorities arbitrarily detained two Egyptian nationals, Mohammed al-Zairi and Ahmed Ajiza. They handed over these two men to US intelligence agents at Stockholm's Bromma Airport. CIA agents were waiting for them in a CIA Gulfstream jet numbered N379P. It's absolutely clear that Sweden has practically become a cog in the conspiracy and intelligence machine of the CIA against independent countries. In this regard, UN committees accused Sweden of violating human rights treaties and the Convention Against Torture. This Swedish setup does not end here. Some members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization and anti-Iran opposition abroad, through colluding with the Swedish prosecutor's office, have been able to play out a pre-designed and imaginary scenario. The members of the MKO, who easily hold a rally in front of the courthouse with the support of the Swedish police, are considered by the Iranian people as a terrorist and dangerous cult. They started a street war in Iran 4 decades ago. Mas'ud Rajavi and the leaders of this terrorist cult resorted to torture and organized assassinations when they failed in their riotous scheme. The MKO even went as far as assassinating the president, the prime minister, the head of Iran's Supreme Court, and more than 70 members of the Iranian parliament. The assassination of a legitimate prime minister is not a strange thing to the Swedish people. The murderers of Olof Palme were never found, and the case was closed. This is while those who assassinated the president and prime minister of Iran have openly confessed to their crimes, yet live freely in Sweden. In addition to the widespread assassinations of government officials, the MKO terrorists also commit child murder, carry out blind street assassinations, bury their opponents alive, engage in organized torture of ordinary people, and ultimately kill 17,000 innocent Iranians. They were close friends of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein set up Camp Ashraf for the group in Iraq so that members of the cult would continue their terrorist activities from there. The MKO stopped short of no crimes, and they helped Saddam in his massacre of the people of the city of Basra and the Kurdish people of Iraq. Interestingly, this terrorist cult, which has the blood of the Iraqi and Iranian people on its hands, currently continues its terrorist activities in Albania with the support of Saudi Arabia, the United States, and some European countries. Despite its legal capacity in the European Union, Sweden is now a tool in the hands of a well-known terrorist group. a group that even the Swedish prosecutor acknowledged to be a terrorist entity in his initial speech at the court. Nevertheless, the trial continues on the basis of a fictional show and mass collusion, and the Swedish court has become the venue for a pre-designed scenario. The question is, for the sake of what organization is the Swedish prosecutor squandering such a huge sum of money at the expense of the Swedish taxpayer? If you think the MKO is the only terrorist group present in Sweden, think again. This man, Habib Asivad, an official employee of the Swedish government, is another terrorist. He is currently on trial in Iran after being arrested for assassinating Iranian people, but his colleagues still live in Sweden. Under the name of Al-Nidal Al-Ahwaziyya movement, they are still plotting terrorist acts against the Iranian people. The story of terrorist groups based in Sweden is not limited to the MKO and Al-Nidal Al-Ahwaziyya. There are other dangerous groups in this country too. ISIS has been defeated in the Middle East, but its Swedish members are back home.
Welcome back to the program. Swedish police have set up a special task force to combat gangs following a wave of violence in...
The people of Sweden and some of the country's political parties have now realized that the policy of harboring murderers and violent groups has not only not brought credibility for Sweden, but also it has come at a heavy cost, including the atmosphere of terror and murder in Swedish society. Many are asking this question today. Isn't it time the rulers of Sweden admitted the failure of this policy? A member of the Swedish Parliament, who was previously one of the children left behind as a result of the ideological divorces at Camp Ashraf, criticized the former Swedish Prime Minister for meeting with the leader of the MKO. He asked the former Prime Minister, "How much did you get paid to lend yourself as an extra to a terrorist group?" Once known as the Land of Peace, Sweden has today become a hotbed of a host of terrorist and criminal groups. Not a week goes by that the media doesn't report a shooting incident. The question is, what would Alfred Nobel think of Sweden's name and symbol if he were here today?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
درست بعد از ماه رمضان روزه دیگه آدم قرار نیست روزه‌ای که روزه شکم هست بگیره اما روزه چشم.
It is true that after the holy month of Ramadan we are not ordered to fast and be hungry or thirsty. However, we can have fast of eyes, ear, tongue and other parts of the body. The main outcome of the holy month of Ramadan, according to the Quran, is to be God-wary and righteous. Precise self-account and self-control is another fruit of the month of Ramadan. In better words, our servitude to Allah must be of a higher quality after the month of Ramadan.
شما ترازوها رو ببینید، ترازوها درجه حساسیتشون با هم فرق میکنه. یه ترازو مثل باسکوله.
Take a look at different types of scales. Some scales are like bascule, which is for weighing heavy things. In other words, it is not that much precise and maybe up to some kilos might be missed in weighing. On the other side, we have digital scales which do not miss even a gram in weighing. After the holy month of Ramadan, our scales must be like a digital scale and not a bascule. Our sensitivity towards sins must be more accurate in the month of Ramadan than before. Our scales of actions must differ before and after the month of Ramadan. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson: what is a jurisprudential fasting? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Religious fasting may be observed in three different levels. Number one is fasting of al-Sharia, which is the jurisprudential fasting. Fasting for many Muslims is mainly to refrain from what they must jurisprudentially refrain from, such as eating, drinking, sexual intercourse, etc. Although this is the lowest and the least level of religious fasting, once it is offered for the sake of Allah, the faster is religiously considered fasting. To give you an idea of how long the level or how low the level of this stage is, let me share some examples with you. A Muslim girl may fast without practicing her Islamic dress code at school, and her fasting is valid on this level because, like we said, it's the lowest level. There are do's and don'ts of this lowest level. So if she's not wearing hijab, but she is performing all those other do's and don'ts which are necessary for fasting, then she is considered to be fasting. A Muslim may observe fasting and yet listen to rock and roll, and his or her fasting is jurisprudentially valid. Again, keep in mind that we're discussing the lowest level of fasting. There's so many other vices that a faster may be performing while he or she is fasting, but their fast would be valid at this lowest level. And this is the jurisprudential fasting. And we're going to discuss this more after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the jurisprudential fasting, which is considered to be the lowest level of fasting for any Muslim. No doubt, the purpose of fasting is not just to avoid food and drink, and hence, this is the very lowest level of fasting for the very beginners to start their journey towards perfection and promotion. Keep in mind that this is not the end. This is the beginning. Thus, it is quoted from the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that many people gain nothing from their fasting save hunger and thirst. Notice how he still qualifies it to be a fast, but he's saying that you don't gain anything more than what you are getting, and that is just hunger and thirst. The Sharia fasting, or the jurisprudential fasting, is prescribed for beginners as a form of training to help them become acquainted to waking up at dawn with the excuse of eating and drinking, lest they feel hungry and thirsty during the day, in order for them to experience the pleasant breeze at dawn, to be awake at a time when the divine cups of spirituality are served. The least he is expected, therefore, to gain by the end of this blessed month of Ramadan is to have gotten used to offering his or her morning prayers on time. This is the least of the expectations. Unfortunately, many people, they're fasting from their childhood, but, you know, they grow older and older and older, but never think about moving beyond this jurisprudential fasting level. this basic level, right? This is a very unfortunate thing. And inshallah, may we not be from amongst those people whose previous year fasts were no different than this year fast. This year, we have to move to the next level. We have to exert ourselves and make sure that we are taking one step further, to say the least. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Contrary to the bank's claim of climate leadership, its pledge to reduce emissions intensity is fully compatible with a massive expansion of fossil fuels, said one campaigner. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Bank of America accused of using accounting tricks as real climate action. Here's the story. Climate action groups denounced Bank of America for displaying one of the worst examples of corporate greenwashing as the bank released its climate targets for 2030, centering their plan of action on reducing carbon emissions intensity instead of reducing their absolute emissions. With CEO Brian Moynihan claiming the bank aims to help ensure a just, stable transition to the sustainable future we all want, the bank announced that it would reduce the intensity of its emissions instead of absolute emissions. Emissions intensity refers to the volume of emissions measured against another unit, while a pledge to reduce absolute emissions would require Bank of America to reduce the amount of emissions it is sending into the atmosphere over time. By using carbon intensity metrics, Bank of America has set up a situation where its overall greenhouse gas emissions could continue to rise until 2030, and it would still be able to claim that it has met its climate goals, said Alec Cannon, co-director of the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition. The bank announced its pledge less than 2 weeks after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released its latest report on the climate crisis, reiterating earlier warnings that the continued extraction of fossil fuels, for which Bank of America has provided at least $232 billion in financing since 2016, will put the Paris Climate Agreement's goal of limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius out of reach. In today's announcement, Bank of America touts its history of climate leadership and then unveils 2030 emissions targets, which are intensity-only, fully compatible with increases in absolute emissions and massive expansion of fossil fuels, especially expanded extraction of fossil gas, said Jason Opinia Disterhoft, senior climate and energy campaigner for Rainforest Action Network. He added, Bank of America's intensity-only targets, which lag well behind U.S. and global best practice, put it firmly on the side of climate delay when time is quickly running out to cut absolute emissions in half by 2030. Bank of America will face a vote at its shareholder meeting on April 26, with some of its investors calling on the bank to commit to policies ensuring its lending and underwriting do not support fossil fuel projects. Cannon expressed hope that the bank's investors will take note of this duplicity and vote in favor of critical climate resolutions. Like too many of its peers, Bank of America is trying to pass off vague pledges and accounting tricks as real climate action, said Sierra Club Fossil Fuel Finance Campaign Manager Ben Cushing, adding, the science is clear that achieving net zero financed emissions by 2050 means stopping funding for the expansion of fossil fuels, he added. Reducing emissions intensity while increasing financing for the fossil fuel industry and overall financed emissions is utterly insufficient to achieve that target and contribute to a climate-stable future.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan.
So we're going to deal with this. In fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, as always. As we are talking about some of the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei regarding Ramadan and fasting, let me ask you this question, Sheikh. You know, we have patients everywhere, actually, and people are sick and are suffering from one disease or another, and some of these diseases in fact require some kind of injections or sprays or serums. For example, just as a case in point, like asthma patients, you know, they need some kind of form of a spray which has a power or vapor-borne powder, you know. And that, obviously, they have to spray it into their lungs through their mouth or the nostrils. So is it really permissible, in fact, to fast while using such sprays or even injection and stuff like that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When it comes to injections, of course, Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the injection is nutritional or intravenous, you know, and it is kind of supporting the body, it is not permissible. But if it is just sedative or comative, you know, and it does not support the body. It's permissible, and there would be no objection.
So serums are always, in fact, impermissible?
Yeah, serums are...
Because they're usually in intravenous, you know?
Yeah, sure. Serums are not allowed. Of course, if it becomes necessary, then the fast becomes void, and he has to give the qada of the fast later after the month of Ramadan.
What about the sprays then for that?
When it comes to the sprays, or what is generally called inhaler, of course, inhalers, according to Supreme Leader, if it is used only to open the respiratory tract, you know, because there are some inhalers or some sprays which serve to open the tract, the respiratory tract, and help give some kind of relief to the respiratory system, of course, it does not invalidate the fast, and there would be no problem.
Even if it has some kind of like water form in it, in the spray? No,
of course, you know, if it goes into the throat and down into the stomach, you know, and then it is not permissible, you know. And if because of, you know, the emergency condition or situation, a person has to take that, you know, has to use the inhaler, and the, you know, the vapor goes into his throat and then into his stomach, of course, the fast becomes void. But because it becomes necessary for that individual to use it, he is not supposed to give any penalty, or he does not become liable for any penalty. He has to simply give the qada of the fast later.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program on RIB English Radio with the program Islamic Laws. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid, still with us in the studio, talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas regarding fasting and Ramadan. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, before the break, I asked you a question about injections, sprays for asthma patients, and serums. Now let's talk about pills. We know that if you eat something, this is one of the invalidating agents, obviously.
Sure.
But what about for those, you know, people suffering from severe diseases, such as, for example, hypertension or high blood pressure, you know, they need to take some pills for their basically health condition. So is it something that is permissible while fasting, or no, it just invalidates the fast?
I should avail myself of this opportunity to explain the rules regarding those people who suffer from, you know, some kind of diseases. Obviously, we should understand that according to the religious authorities, including Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, if fasting aggravates the disease or hampers that disease, and actually delays the process of recovery, then it's not permissible to observe fast. And of course, if even a person fears that fasting might affect his or her health, it's not permissible to fast in that scenario. But when it comes to taking pills, of course, you know, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that if taking these pills during Ramadan is necessary for actually controlling the high blood pressure, then it is permissible, but it will definitely invalidate the fast. So when the fast becomes invalid, he will have to observe the qada after Ramadan, when of course it's not necessary to take pills. For example, when he is certain that his blood pressure is stable and it's not going to, and then fasting will not increase his pressure, blood pressure, of course, he will have to observe the fast of Ramadan, and there's no kafara or penalty whatsoever to give after Ramadan.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. And another question would be regarding, in fact, the sexual intercourse, Sheikh Javid. If we know that during the month of Ramadan, a man and his wife could have, the sexual intercourse as long as they are not fasting. I mean, like between iftar and sahar.
Yeah.
But what are the rules concerning the sexual intercourse in general? Would you shed some light on it?
There's no doubt as to the fact that sexual intercourse is one of the invalidating agents, and it does make the fast void when the parties to the sexual intercourse in fact are fasting. Mm-hmm. If in the month of Ramadan they are either traveling or maybe they mm-hmm. are not fasting for one reason or another, it is permissible for them to have sexual intercourse or physical intimacy. And in the said case, I think you just said that it is, for example, the man has sexual intercourse with his wife and with her consent.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if both sides consent to sexual intercourse, then both sides are liable for kafara, because sexual intercourse is forbidden while fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And because not only the fast becomes void, but they should also pay the mm-hmm. Penalty or the kafara, which is to mm-hmm. fast for 60 days mm-hmm. 31 days in a row, or feed 60 mm-hmm. people to their fill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Please keep us in your prayers and supplications.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.